got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here as always. Kevin, what's going on?
Oh, nothing. Had a great day today. Met with some growers in the state that are expanding indoor operations. So that whole idea of growing plants in inside space is a really big deal, which is cool because it's what I've studied forever. So it seems like things are merging and it's been a really fun day for research. So there's that.
That sounds very exciting. I don't have anything nearly as cool. It is Girl Scout cookie season, so I have lots of those laying around the house. That's a bad thing.
But you're almost like, how many more months until you're a dad with an external being?
About 4 months. About 4 months. Yeah, things are going along. So I've got Girl Scout cookies and a son on the way. So that's my life right now.
Well, that's pretty cool. You know, that's good. So what's the tie in there? I don't know, but
cookies are made with wheat and you can grow wheat indoors now. There you go.
There you go.
Very all good. Right, well, let's jump into some stories and I'll stop telling stupid dad jokes. So first up, COVID shots and the mark of the beast. Battling religious vaccine misinformation. Kevin's thrilled for that one. Next up, Gene Gun, the tool that revolutionized plant breeding and brought GMOs into agriculture. And finally, growing food in space may offer sustainability benefits beyond genetically engineering crops on Earth. But first up, let's deal with the looniest and nuttiest of conspiracies, Kevin. So tell us about this story.
I did a facepalm so bad that I almost knocked So here's the story, and this is a big deal, and it was really illuminating to read this today because it taught me a lot about some stuff I've seen in my community. So here we go. So it turns out that there's a lot of folks who really feel that vaccination and masks are signals of the biblical end times. And then apparently the book of Revelation tells us that there is the mark of the beast, which will be worn on the forehead or wrist. So I'm doing my mask wrong if that's the case. that will signal the end of times, that you'll need to have this for commerce, that you'll need to have this for whatever. And so the whole idea is that there is a very active movement on social media and in other places that indicate that vaccines against COVID, mask wearing, all this rhetoric around public health is actually the mark of the beast. And it's this apocalypse that's pending where the Antichrist will test Christians to whether or not they will accept the mark of the beast. And it's really funny because I know people who I really like, who I don't know personally. All I know is that they have 8 million kids and they will not wear masks and they refuse to do it. And those who do, they look at us like we are the ones who have sold out, you know? And I think there's a lot of religious folks who really believe that this is the case, that this is Book of Revelation playing out. And it's, I guess, kind of a signal that, you know, faith is telling us that this is just, you know, being tested. This is God testing us and all that stuff. And on social media, it's turned into a big deal because people have been saying that this is the mark of the beast, that that if you are wearing a mask or getting a vaccine, which some say is made of fetal tissue, you're simply capitulating to Satan or to the Antichrist. I don't know what the difference is. I don't know that stuff. But the idea is that Facebook and other social media avenues have been trying to figure out, can I really eliminate that information, or is that religious protected freedom of speech? And so you see where this gets into this weird area in terms of Facebook and social media, because people are spreading this information and they don't know if they can suppress that as bad medical advice. So that's where we are.
And I want to dive into that in a second, but I just want to say, as a Christian myself, this is the dumb guy interpretation of Revelation. Just want to, I want to put that out there. And I know this is parenthetical to the overall arc of the story, but that section of the book is historical. The mark of the beast is a reference to the Roman Emperor Nero, almost certainly. And this is, most historians will concede this or acknowledge this. So it's not a future reference to things that are playing out. And I'm sure you're a little bit older than me, Kevin, so you've seen even more of this, but there are throughout history, there have been best-selling books and movies and all kinds of goofy religious leaders who will say, this political leader or this religious figure is the Antichrist, and they're going to usher in the end of the world. And then the person either dies or just becomes politically irrelevant, and then they move on to the next guy. And this has been going on for centuries now. And so I think that's crucial to point out, that like even within the religious community, these people are like the fringy of the fringest, you know what I'm saying? So I wanted to get that out of the way, but let's go on more to like the impact of this conspiracy and maybe how we deal with it.
Well, let's go back to that for a second though, because I think that mainstream religion can dismiss this. But my dad used to take me, because one of his employees was way into end times, Nostradamus and all that stuff. And he made me go to speeches when I was like 14, 13, with some guy named like Dr. Charles Taylor. And he would talk all about how it was, you know, don't worry about it, it's the end of times, you know, go have a good time, forget it, you're never going to grow up, which was a great message for me when I was 13. I was like, yeah. I guess I will take up smoking. but this stuff has been going around, and it's certainly cyclical, but there are people today, and I live in Florida and in rural Florida, and there's a lot of people who do subscribe, I believe, to the fact that, because they refuse to wear masks or get vaccinated. And they feel, and this is a very deep conviction, and I don't think it ties in necessarily with the, you know, government telling you what to do. I believe it's much more religious conviction.
No, you're right about that. But I think my point in diving into that stuff was just to undermine what, like, they're referencing. They're like, well, the Bible tells me so. And I'm saying, well, no, the Bible doesn't tell you so. I'm sorry.
Maybe their Bible tells them so.
Yeah.
Different version. I don't know. But I was trying to think of what version that would be. But anyway,
it's in none of them. That's the point. But I can relate to what you're saying, because I remember as a kid being horrified at like, the world's going to end. What am I going to do?
You know? Yeah. So I know, but no sense in investing, you know, but I appreciate your clarification on that. And I'm glad you mentioned what you did.
Yeah. But let's get into the rub of the issue, which is, how do we deal with this? Because I have to be upfront. I am very concerned about the direction society is going. We're getting, and I've mentioned this before, we're getting much more comfortable with, I'm just going to shut you up if I don't like what you're saying. Now, maybe in certain circumstances that is justifiable, but as an overall trend, I'm very concerned about that. So how do you suss out this issue between free speech and trying to keep the facts so people aren't misled?
Yeah, that's a tough one. But, you know, because for me, I believe everything is a marketplace of ideas. And I think we should have free everything. I would love people to use, if they feel it's their place, to freely use racial epithets or whatever, so that I can identify who I don't like better. You know, I want people to speak freely so we know where everybody is. You know, I want to know who the loser in the room is. Right now, it's really hard to tell, because we've taken all the racist jerks and other folks I don't like and driven them underground. The fact that people don't speak their mind makes us harder and harder for us to tell who are the people we really need to be careful with. And I understand, you know, we don't want everyone spewing offensive hate speech. I get that. But at the same time, it makes it very difficult, you know, for us to identify who we should and shouldn't trust. And when we look in the case of medical information, like on COVID, this kind of thing does make it very difficult because I want people to talk freely about it. If there is a problem, we should know about it. The problem is that here free expression endangers public health. And so they're kind of, you know, it's a really tough line to draw. But the solution is we shouldn't have censorship. We should have more people teaching critical thinking. And if the people who were spreading false information were properly ostracized for doing it, then maybe the problem would go away on its own. And I'd rather see an educated populace not subscribing to this garbage than Facebook, Instagram, Twitter doing the job of police for me.
I'm really glad to hear you say that. And I was actually ready to sort of argue with you about this because I didn't know where you would land on it. But I want to add just two things to that and comment on these, if you would. The first is that, to build on what you said, I think if you kick people off social media, they're going to build their own websites. They're going to go back to online forums. They're going to go to alternative platforms. And now they have this sort of martyr complex. And now they're going to use that to sell their message. And the anti-vax movement does this all the time. So if you kick them off, they're going to say, look, they're afraid of the truth that we're telling, blah, 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 blah. So I think there's a risk that this could backfire. And then my second concern is that I don't trust the Washington Post and the New York Times and the LA Times and Facebook and Twitter. I don't trust these organizations to safeguard the science. And Kevin, as you know very much from personal experience, these newspapers are horrible on occasion. They're not consistently unreliable, but sometimes they promote nonsense about science. They write stories that are falsely balanced. They will talk to one side of a debate and they won't talk to another. This happens a lot with the Environmental Working Group and their Dirty Dozen. You know, the season's sure. Coming up, by the way. So we're going to see all these stories about, you know, pesticides on cherries and so forth. And so for those reasons, I'm really concerned about this sort of trend we're seeing towards, well, we're just going to shut people up. I think that's very, very dangerous.
No, you're exactly right. You know, who decides who is the truth teller? And we know that the media can make mistakes and does make mistakes, unless I'm still waiting for my check as someone on the inner circle of corporate lobbyists and consultants who guides decisions within companies. I mean, come on. They make mistakes. And so it really goes back to the idea of educating people in critical thinking, but moreover, winning trust in appropriate ways. And to me, I always was able to change people's minds and have these kinds of micro conversions because they let me into their forum. That when I show up and have the discussion rationally, calmly, and logically inside their chat room of their or their chat room, inside their, you know, Facebook page or whatever it is, then I kind of win some of the people in the middle. You never convert the wackos, but you do sway the folks who can be changed. And we need to be focusing on more of that and inviting more discussion. It's just the problem is it takes time. And in a pandemic, do we really have the time to change those hearts and minds rather than just turn off the spigot of bad information? And it's a tough place to be.
Yeah, there's no good answer. And that just seems to be the running theme on this show. And I guess in the world today, right, it's like no matter what you do, there's going to be a downside. There's going to be a cost. But it seems to me, at least, it's just not worth it to live in a society where whoever's in charge, and right now you may be okay with who's in charge and who's being kicked off the internet, but in 10 years, who knows? You know what I'm saying? It goes both ways. And so yeah. We have to be very careful. But I guess we can leave it there. And let's talk about our next story, Kevin.
Well, what's the next story? You're the guy in charge of the order here. I don't, all I do is show up and blab about it.
Yeah. That's awesome. So the next story is Gene Gun, the tool that revolutionized plant breeding and brought GMOs into agriculture.
Yeah, Gene Gun, probably the worst WWF wrestler.
Eugene Gunn.
So this is a really cool story. This is by Matthew Wilder, the Progressive Farmer. And it was about this thing that has been beat to death called the Gene Gun. And the Gene Gun has a really bad reputation. It needs a better publicist. The idea goes back to 1986. And in 1986, there was a professor at Cornell University named John Sanford. And he used to use literally a 22 caliber pistol charge to shoot particles into plant tissue. And so he would coat the particles, either tungsten or gold particles, cover them with DNA, and then literally hit that primer, and then bang, you hear this big explosion, and those particles would shoot through tissue. And when the particles went through tissue, some of the DNA would fall off. And when you leave DNA laying around a cell, the cell says, wait a minute, that's not in the right place, and shoves it into the nucleus and into the genome in random weird places usually. And that's how people were presumably going to transform plants, and it worked. It was a little bit crude, and so others started to go and develop a gene gun, you know, in quotes, with electricity. Could you salvage, and this was a parascientist who salvaged a bunch of old radar station parts and used a giant capacitor hooked up to a voltmeter and a bunch of vacuum tubes and put DNA in a droplet of water and electrocuted it in the presence of cells and these particles that were, you know, the particles coated with DNA. And it turns out that cells would, in the charge, would open up their membranes and cell walls fast enough to be able to sneak in some of the particles with DNA. DNA would fall off and go incorporated into the cell. And so this thing now is in the Smithsonian. And this was Martinelli and McCabe. I can't remember the first names, but Dennis McCabe. They made this device that for all intents and purposes was so dangerous, not OSHA compliant. This thing would kill you if you made a mistake. I mean, it was fatal levels of electricity that did this charge, and it worked. And this was actually one of the tools at AgriCetus, which used to be in Middleton, Wisconsin, right by the side of the highway there, by the side of the Beltline outside of Madison, Wisconsin, that would go into history as being important to developing the first Roundup Ready soybeans. So this was a really important tool in plant biology, and that's why it's sitting in the Smithsonian. So that's kind of the birth of what they called the gene gun. And we've all seen like weird pictures of this in the anti-GMO literature, but a really cool tool and innovative thought. 1986. It's 35 years old now.
So I'm wondering, Kevin, because this goes back before my time, but was this discussed publicly, like the story of how this specific technology was developed? Because when I read the story and you know, reading about this previously, it always seemed like such a great example of people doing good science, you know, taking an idea that was kind of mocked initially, and people like, well, that's stupid, that'll never work. And then the two of them were like, no, this actually might work, let's try it. And then, you know, they do experiments and they refine the technology, and then all of a sudden Monsanto wants to buy it and use it. So my question is, if this story had gotten out in front of the public and it was correctly explained to people, would this have sort of dampened the anti-GMO concern? Because when I read this, it just seemed so practical and so cool, really. I think it would have done away with a lot of the mystery and the concern that surrounds this technology. What do you think about that?
Yeah, maybe, because it's kind of kitschy and wacky that, you know, a couple of guys in their garage making a thing, to DNA delivery device. It's got a lot more of that, you know, Jobs and Wozniak feel to it. But I don't know that it would necessarily be too exciting. First of all, it's called a gene gun. So when you call anything a gun, people always kind of look weird at it, right? I mean, it's kind of these days, especially, I mean, kids get suspended because they chew a piece of cheese into a gun shape and hold it at somebody, you know, that kind of thing. Actually, I saw a road rage thing today that was pretty cool. This guy's yelling at this woman out of his car and just like totally going at her. It's horrible. And I was going to yell at him, but then I figured he had like all these gun stickers on his car and I figured I'd get shot and die an ironic road rage death. Like I would, like the guy who is doing road rage, I would be road raging at him. So let it go. But anyway, the whole idea of making a gene gun, now if they would have called it the particle delivery device, you know, maybe it would have been had something to work with. And actually that's what it was called when Bio-Rad, the company out of California, bought this patents to do this. They developed what they called a microparticle delivery device, which was you would put all the DNA coated tungsten particles on a little disc and then use a shot of helium, like a burst of helium under high pressure would shatter that disc and shoot those particles into your tissue. And it worked. The big deal is, though, is that this kind of technology was not reliable and reproducible enough compared to Agrobacterium, the plant pathogen that does the genetic exchange that's used in most genetic engineering. So, you know, I don't know that this thing really would have been accepted differently if it was explained to the public differently. It still had too many weird edges of, you know, unnatural and shooting genes into plants. Too many stinky edges.
Fair enough. And maybe I'm projecting how I perceive it, you know, because in my mind, when I learn something about science like that and I grasp the concept, I go, that's super cool. I want to learn more about that. And I develop an appreciation for it, but maybe that's just me, you know, other people perceive it differently. So I guess.
But what is cool about that is that a lot. Yeah. Well, here's what's cool about that is that, you know, it is a great example of how you can solve a major transformative problem in biology with a really low rent solution. And nowadays we're all looking for some technical solution for every single problem when really what it is it's about going back to nuts and bolts and saying, what are the properties we can control? How do we do it? What's the easiest way for us to get to where we need to be? And I really respect the folks who are not afraid to go into the junk closet, find a bunch of stuff and find a solution to their problem. And that's what's really exciting about this.
Yeah, it's very cool. Well, we'll just leave it as an interesting science history lesson for those who like that. And let's talk about grown plants in space.
Ooh, love it. So this one is by Megan Tatum in Wired. Growing food in space may offer sustainability efforts beyond genetic engineering on Earth. And this is a good story with a good punchline that I really wonder about some of the content. Well, we'll get into that a bit. So they really focused this around some grapevine pieces that were shot in the space and spent some time on the International Space Station. So 320 grapevines. And the idea was, if we put grapevine segments in the space, they'll be in microgravity and they'll be in radiation. And so maybe it'll screw up their DNA. So when we bring them back, things will be beneficial and they will do better. And so these were like Merlot and Cabernet, you know, chunks of grapevine. And all of them have pathogen problems that you have to protect them with chemistry and everything else in order to have grapes for wine. So they thought, well, we'll shoot these into space. And when they come back, their messed up DNA will make them immune to certain diseases. And that was the major idea. The point of the article is that space offers a unique environment to challenge plants with stress. And when you do that, you start to see that plants can have genetic alterations or differences in adaptations that maybe can make them more amenable to surviving stress here on Earth. That's the major take-home message.
So how practical is this? I mean, the cost and the, you know, the having to actually go into space with plants. I mean, like, how viable is this because from reading the article, that the impression I got was, this is super cool. Here's the concept. Here's how it could work. But even at the end of the article, they said, you know, we can't really talk publicly about the kind of changes that we were able to induce. And I understand that, you know, for you know, intellectual property reasons, I understand why you couldn't speak about it, but it just like, they built it up for 1,000 words and they're like, look at this cool next generation stuff we're doing, but we can't tell you about it. So you're the plant scientist. Is there anything to this?
Well, this is what's so hilarious about this. It costs somewhere in the order of $35,000 a kilogram to shoot stuff into space just to get it off the earth. And so they're trying to use this high-end, highfalutin method of changing DNA and scrambling DNA and making crazy changes that we can't predict and we have no idea what they do. Yet, that's exciting and interesting, and they're doing it for the European consumer who won't find other types of genetic modification that are horribly precise and exact very acceptable. And so this is what's so weird about this, that you're able to shoot the stuff into space to cause mutations and major changes that occur. Some are epigenetic, so changes that aren't even in DNA, changes that are at the level of how DNA is packaged. And these changes could make the wine grapes better. But they're doing it in a way that makes absolutely no sense. They're doing it in ways that are random, that are just, you know, overall destructive. We don't know what they are. We can assess them after the fact. But the funny part is, the folks in the EU say, well, we don't really care if it's scrambled and crazy. This is perfectly acceptable and super cool because it was in space. So that's the weird part about this. They're spending a lot of money to achieve what we could do on Earth with a couple drops of a simple chemical.
Yeah, and that was actually really funny to me because I could see, again, this is the cynic in me coming out, but I could see this technology being developed over the next couple of decades, and eventually you start getting some plant varieties that are commercialized that have been developed this way, and then you get sort of a rehash. You know, it's the GMO 3.0 debate where now you have, you know, earth-grown food, you know, earth-only food. It's an official label, and, you know, so I just don't understand how that would play out. You know, it just seems like this could be victimized in the same way that genetic engineering was. And who knows if this will ever materialize. But I could see people in Europe, for example, going, we're not eating space food. No way, you know? So I don't know what to make of it.
Well, see, I think they would totally dig space food. Like space food, I think that going to space for your mutations is totally acceptable. But installing variation on Earth is not. It's much more European to be on a space station and getting your DNA wrecked. And that's what's so weird about this, is that they're talking about doing things like bananas, tomatoes, and putting those things into space. And there's even like a commercial ventures now to shoot plant material into space for radiation treatments when we have plenty of radiation here. There's a Texas company, try to find the name of it here, called NanoRax, which they must have bought the URL from an out-of-business gentleman's club. They have a team that is going to just put plant material in space for mutation that then can bring back. And that's not to say that, you know, all mutations are equivalent. Maybe there is something about space that can give more mutations or better epigenetic mutations. You know, we know on Earth that we're discovering now that if you put plants in a high nitrous oxide environment, it can cause some certain mutations. Really interesting stuff, but it just seems like a long way around to get what we can already do here through a very simpler means. And what's ironic to me is that shooting it into space seems to be perfectly acceptable and exciting and interesting, and a glass of wine that any European would be glad to drink. Yet if you did it here on Earth, it would not be acceptable. Strange irony.
Yeah, it's kind of odd. I guess the one good thing is that this is being funded by private actors. These are private biotech and space companies that are doing this. So if they want to burn cash on this and maybe something useful comes out, then by all means. So that's the upside, is you and I aren't paying for it right now.
And but anyways, that's been a big thing with space biology. You know, the SpaceX and the private enterprise has really driven space biology forward very quickly, and space exploration, space activity forward at a much better space than it would have, much better rate than it would have been done otherwise. So that's a really good thing that's happening.
Very good. Very good. Well, we'll leave it there for the week, and tell us who you're following on Twitter, Kevin.
Well, one of the folks who I really appreciate, and this is maybe a little local and close to home and maybe not appropriate for the segment in its true spirit and intent, but is Dr. Gene McAvoy, and he's at Florida Veg Man. And maybe you're not in the vegetables, maybe you're not in the Florida, maybe you're not in the men, but Florida Veg Man is somebody I follow because he puts out outstanding words of wisdom that are always spot on. And he's a friend, he's a colleague here in the state, a retired extension agent who just does beautiful work. He's very embedded with the Florida vegetable industry and the vegetable industry nationwide, but always has great posts, and I would really recommend following him. So there you go. What about you?
I'm going to recommend people follow a scientist named Ben Lockwin. He is he's on the advisory board of the Genetic Literacy Project. And if you want to know about COVID vaccines or anything related to the virus itself, then I think he's an excellent resource. He's been called, this is from NPR, they called him the Neil deGrasse Tyson of COVID-19. So follow him and he'll interact with you on Twitter. He's one of the scientists that will do that. And I believe he's on the advisory committee that recommends to the FDA whether or not to approve these vaccines. So he knows this stuff. He's very, very intimately involved in this. So he is at Ben Lockwin, and it's just BenLockwin. So check him out. And thank you guys so much for joining us. We'll be back next week. Kevin and I are on Twitter as well, at CamJEnglish, at Kevin Folta, geneticliteracyproject.org. Like the show, give us all the stars, retweet us when the episodes come out. We thank you very much, and we'll see you next week.